I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, if you heard the interviews yesterday, let me just read you a couple things. It's from Bob Nielsen. Listening to Sledge again for a second time made me realize when you're in combat with the grunts, your values change dramatically, and you really don't know it. Life takes on a different meaning. Good guys, i.e. Marines, have far different values, even the shitbirds, than the enemy, the Viet Cong. Your values and life turn upside down. And when you return to the rear or go back home, you're supposed to be, quote, normal, unquote. And you're never really normal. You can hide it and cover it up, but it's always there in some small way. Another reason post-traumatic winning is so damn important. Here's another one. Good morning, Mac. The first interview with Gene Sledge was great. We have lost most of these men now. However, to hear a man who has seen the horrors of war and survived, he is honest with respect, but construes how we as Americans had to learn to fight hard and brutal to win a war. Look forward to part two. And hope you get his son on. Be well. Dave in Vacaville. It's been pretty cool. Now, I will put up for you in this post the link to his digital archives, and I would encourage you, there's all kinds of awesome stuff in there. There's letters that people sent to him. It gives you some sense of him. Included in his papers are two letters from a woman who he wrote to. He evidently saw a letter that she wrote. Her son, her only child, was killed on Peleliu. He was a platoon sergeant, and she includes a picture of him in the letter. And she talks about him, and that he is a big guy, over 200 pounds. He went ashore on Peleliu weighing 170 pounds. He was in Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. And Sledge evidently saw her letter in the Gazette or Leatherneck and responded to it. I was not in your son's unit, but I served on Peleliu. So, I mean, it gives you some sense of his sense of dignity and compassion. And then I read in hour one, I read a little excerpt from a letter where he was pissed that a guy wouldn't let him identify Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, in what the guy wrote about him. And he said, look, I'm hard on this now. If you want me to help you, and he got great publicity out of riding with the old breed, as well he should have. And it's looked at as a classic. It's, you know, the basis for a couple of different documentaries, or one of the works that is the basis for a couple of different documentaries. So yeah, he gets pissed when they won't allow him to identify Kilo Company 3-5. And so you see him, the human being, and that's what's beautiful about all of this. So I will get out of the way. I will put that link to his papers at Auburn University, and you can go, and I would suggest you could look at the pictures. But if you read his correspondence, you consistently get this picture painted for you of this very, very smart, very humble, very articulate, very compassionate Marine mortarman who is devoutly devoted to his fellow sailors and Marines of Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. So Without further ado, here is part two of Studs Terkel and Gene Sledge. Just to set this up, the tape runs out, right? And I'm not sure if they had cassettes then in 1981. I think they did, maybe. And who knows if Studs Terkel was using one. But whatever he did, he rethreaded it or flipped the cassette. And you'll hear him talking to Sledge as he flips the cassette and turns it on before they resume their conversation, which is kind of interesting. So here they are.
It's your story.
Yeah, but I don't want to ramble on.
No. I like this rambling. Why, this is very moving. We almost have what I'm looking for. But I want your reflections. Because here you are. We're sitting here. I'm watching this area, hillside here. This gentle thing. You said, in the very beginning, you said, do you think it's ironic when I said, here are you, this Marine in battle. Not the John Wayne figure, not the swaggering macho, whoever it might be, Errol Flynn in our time.
Yeah.
Not Clint Eastwood. Rather, E.B. Eugene B. Sledge, teacher of biology, bird lover, bird watcher, or a specialist in ornithology. And you don't believe in violence, you know.
I don't like violence, but there are times when you can't help it. I mean, because like you say, in World War II, we had no choice.
Hmm.
But I don't really watch TV very much. That's my personal choice. I have a lot of reading I like to do and want to do, and I like to be outdoors. But I don't even like to watch television shows. For instance, these things where someone is coming after someone who's unarmed and they're helpless, and you know, these all these to do with these psychopathic killers they have on TV today, you know, and all these, and then they say this violence doesn't affect children and so forth, and then they turn right around and say, well, we can teach children with the television. It kind of confuses me. Mm-hmm. But the point is that it bothers me to see just on a film somebody threatening the life of someone else. Or maybe what really bothers me more is I hate to see anything afraid, because I was afraid so much for so long. And what it, in a sense, all boiled down to, I guess, was I got so tired of being scared. You know, I mean, you just got so tired of being scared. And, you know, day after day, you literally knew that the only thing you had was that particular moment you were living right then. And I mean, I've seen guys go through three campaigns and get killed at Okinawa the last day. You know, I mean, just the tragedy of it. And so you had to develop an attitude where you might say in a sense lived for the moment. And I suppose the effect it had on me after the war was it just bothers me to see anybody mistreat anything or anybody. But by the same token, there are certain things that have to be done, and I think this was one thing about our training that was made it so effective. And I don't, from what I saw of Army outfits during the war, I the guys were like we were, but they were trained differently.
Mm.
And I think our training was very, very realistic, and it comes across to the public into the movies as sometimes being brutal. Well, now maybe there were cases where there were excesses after the war. Incidentally, I don't know of a case in World War II where a drill instructor was brutal to recruits. My drill instructor made us do things that might have sounded brutal, but when you came down to brass tacks, he knew what we were going to face.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, he later came over as a replacement and was at Okinawa. I didn't know it until after the war, and was a machine gun sergeant, was wounded at Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, for people to get out and face what we had to face and survive, you can't train them like Boy Scouts. And this, to some people, is ironic. You know, they feel that how could you you know, how could you endorse Marine Corps training and so forth, and the way it is, and yet you don't like violence, the military, and all that. Well, if you're going to live in a free country, you better not criticize the military. That is, unless the military carries on excesses and so forth and interferes with civilian freedoms and so forth, which in our country, fortunately, it doesn't. But and what I'm talking about is World War II. That's, and I'm not making any generalization. I'm just,
you say you live with fear all the time. Fear.
Just constant. Yeah. And of course, there were different intensities.
Of course.
Different intensities, but... and then, too, the thing that bothered me so much, ultimately, even worse than fear itself, was, of course, you know, FDR said all we have to fear is fear itself, but I got so tired of seeing guys get hit and get banged up. And because the more of that you saw, then the more you felt like you could take it out on the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And then the feeling grew and grew, and I guess you became more and more calloused, you know.
You never met a Jap. Did you ever, during that campaign, get to know one?
Oh, no. Well, one of the few we captured at Okinawa could speak English, and he was a Yale graduate, and he was a lieutenant, and he surrendered, he and his one of his sergeants, and they surrendered and came into us when this road cut right down at the tip end of the island. The battle was almost over, and the Japanese sniper started firing at them, you know, to try to kill them, because the snipers knew they had surrendered. And my platoon sergeant said, "Get behind this rock, you crazy son of a bitch. What are you going to do, stand there and get yourself killed?" And this Japanese lieutenant smiled and said, "Yes, sir," and came and got down behind this rock by us. But we never said anything to him, and he spoke perfect English. But I've heard of people, you know, who've talked to Japanese veterans and so forth. I never have myself. I must be perfectly honest with you, I still have a great deal of feeling about it.
I don't hear about that.
I don't mean present-day Japan. But I mean the way they fought, and I don't think you can erase this from the record, that the Germans are constantly getting thrown into their face the horrors of Nazism. But who reminds Japan of what they did to China, or what they did to the Filipinos? And periodically Americans will remember Bataan and this kind of thing, but... No, I think it was because of their Bushido code that apparently they feel, I don't know much about Japanese culture, but they feel that you can reach perfection in various ways by having various things, so flower arranging and this, that, and the other, and music and so forth, to reach a very fine art. And the art of the warrior was Bushido.
Again, irony, flower arranging and Bushido.
Yeah. Well, incidentally, we very often got pictures off of a dead Japanese, photographs that they had taken in China or somewhere like this, because the Japanese we fought at Peleliu had fought in Manchuria, and then had been sent down to the Pacific, and it was a real veteran outfit. And it always struck me as ironic. Here would be this Japanese soldier sitting down in a chair in a typical 1940s period photographic studio with a, you know, maybe a screen behind him or something, and a table with a little flower arrangement on the table. It always struck me as so strange. Here's this guy, and very often they would be holding their rifle. I remember one of the guys got a picture of one that had a knee mortar, you know, a small grenade launcher type mortar, and yet there was always that little, or usually that little table with a little vase of flowers.
Funny. By the way, you know, the set here, you wouldn't buy one of these, would you? This is a Sony.
Well, I don't know.
Tell me the truth.
No, I don't think I'd have any objection to that. A lot of people condemn the Japanese today and say I wouldn't buy Japanese products, but those people are on the ball, and they to me, they have transferred their same dedication, and it was called fanaticism in World War II, to production.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Today, I mean, that's the way it seems to me. Yeah. And people curse the Japanese automakers, and they, because they say, well, they've almost run Detroit out of business and all this. Well, but I mean, they solve a need for an economy car with low maintenance and so forth. I don't have a Japanese car. I would rather buy American products. My car is an American automobile, except for an ancient Volkswagen I have. But I think most Americans don't understand the Japanese. Mm-hmm. They don't understand them now, and they didn't understand them then. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. This is marvelous. Well, you know, I've got an hour here.
Oh,
well, yes. But I'm just taking any thought, just general, because I like your reflections very much. So you saw the kids yourself, too, I suppose. But you saw these young boys. You were 19, the other kids are 19, 20. So you saw innocent kids, a little scared, but not letting their bodies down. You saw them day after day. Change.
That's right, yeah. I think the authors like to refer to them as seasoned veterans or some humbug like that, but I guess we all became sort of calloused and hardened, and but to me, as a biologist and as a scientist, life is really a miracle. I mean, I minored in biochemistry when I got my PhD, and it was one of the most fascinating areas that I ever studied, and I came pretty close to going into cancer research, but the primary reason I didn't was because I liked being outdoors. Mm-hmm. And as a biologist, you know, on the campus, I can, you know, have ornithology, I can go out, you know, get out on field trips and things like this. But when you really get down to it, the people who are really specialists in these areas will tell you that life is, even at the level of an amoeba or something like that, is an absolute miracle. I mean, you can put all the chemical ingredients together and yet it's not alive. And yet we were out there, human beings, the most highly developed mentally, the most highly developed form of life that we know of, certainly on Earth, and fighting each other like a bunch of savages. I mean, and I'm literally, I've talked to veterans of other areas, and they rarely ran into as much of this knockdown, drag-out, kind of just fight to the bitter end the way we did. Now, because there were different kinds of fear, and different kinds of stress, and what the movies love to emphasize is the hand-to-hand combat business. Well, of course, you had to be trained in that to give you self-confidence, because if you didn't, the Japanese, I don't know whether you'd say they loved it, but they sure went in for it, particularly at night, and they'd slip up real close and then jump in. And if you didn't know how to protect yourself with a K-bar, or if you couldn't shoot one of them first, you were in bad shape. But to me, we all had different kinds of mania, about the thing we were most afraid of. To me, the most horrible thing was to be under shell fire, because it was this absolute...
Under shell fire.
Yeah, absolute feeling of helplessness, you know, and this thing comes... Okinawa, the Japanese had 150 millimeter howitzers, you know, and of course they have bigger calibers today, but in the world and the military had bigger ones then. But you know, this dang thing comes roaring in there. It sounds like a train or a jet aircraft coming, and all of a sudden it goes off with this terrific crash. The ground shakes, you know, and all this shrapnel goes ripping and tearing through the air. And oh God, I remember one night, one afternoon, real late at Okinawa. We were on this Half Moon Hill there, and there was a foxhole next to me with two boys in it. And the one next to that had three in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fairly quiet. We had this shell come screeching over, and we could like I say, I was a veteran of Pella, been through a good bit of Okinawa by then, and you could tell what caliber it was and where it was coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to learn that quick. Mm-hmm. We could tell this was coming from behind the lines. And, you know, to be shelled by just the anonymous incoming artillery shells was one thing, but this obviously was from probably a 70 millimeter mountain gun, as the Japanese called it. And it was aimed to fire. The crew was apparently firing it at us, just like a rifle. Well, the shell went off past us and exploded near some knocked out American tanks. And somebody said, "My God Almighty, that's a 70 millimeter mountain gun. He's shooting that thing like a damn rifle." Right. The next shell studs came right over. The guy, two foxholes down from me, was sitting on the side of his foxhole, drinking a cup of hot chocolate out of, you know, a little, he was a Steno tablet, and it was sea ration chocolate. That shell must have passed no more than a foot over my head. And I was observing for the mortar, so I was in the foxhole by myself. And the thing went over me and went and exploded in that foxhole two holes down. Now, that must have been, I guess, maybe 20 yards away or maybe a little more. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was more than that, maybe 30. But the point is, I saw this guy go up in the air. The other two didn't even move. The two kids next to me just fell over. You know, they were both sitting up in the foxhole, and they just fell over backwards. And the immediate thing I had to do, because this was what you had to do, I had to go see if I could help. And believe me, if I ever didn't want to get out of a foxhole, it was then, because I figured he was going to fire again. And the concussion was terrific. And I got up and started over there, and I took about two steps, and I just knew that gun was going to fire again. I took about two steps, and one of the two officers left in the company, we had seven originally, but we only had about two by then, said, "Sledgehammer, get back on the mortar," which was about 25, 30 yards behind the front lines. "Get back on the mortar, because we have to send a patrol out to try to find that gun, that Jap gun, and you're more experienced gun on than the kid on the mortar now." So I just spun around, and I mean, I ran down that ridge and across that mud like a duck running on the water. I wanted to get out of this bay. But I just, you know, I mean, I knew all three of the guys in the second foxhole over. The two next to me were replacements. But to make a long story short.
No, go ahead.
The two in the hole next to me were dead. They were killed instantly. The one who was blown into the air was the only one who survived. And would you believe that his name is Bill Layden, L-E-Y-D-E-N, and he lives in New York. And would you believe that today Bill gets partial disability for wounds he received at Nicosibus, at Palau, and at Okinawa, shrapnel wounds. But his record doesn't say anything about concussion. He has seizures where he can't, you know, epileptic, he can't drive an automobile. But they say, well, you don't have concussion on your record, so you can't get this. But my God, he was blown up. He was the one that went up into the air.
And he gets probably very little, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, probably. I don't, he's never told me he's very proud. I've seen him at the Marine, any of the reunions.
They pay, you know, absolutely.
But there's something, they say, "Oh, he's another guy trying to be a freeloader," you see. And yes, Bill got blown up into the air.
So he doesn't get paid for that.
No.
He was blown up in.
Now, if you don't call that concussion, my God, what is concussion? And do you see the people back in the medical company? We call them medical companies, they were Navy medical companies that handled our wounded. They were too busy trying to save lives to fill out records on exactly what, you know, what happened. But anyway, one of the two guys in the hole with Bill, one of them, his leg was severed at the ankle. And I was back on the mortar, and they brought the stretcher cases by, and Bill was just groaning. He was unconscious. And this other guy was from Washington. He'd been a lumberjack. He must have been maybe no more than 21, but he had been a lumberjack, you know. And I used to tell him always how good I thought Christmas trees smelled, you know. He said, "Oh, Sledgehammer, we got trees out there that smell that good." And he'd talk about how good those trees smelled, you know, in those spruce forests and all. And we were all muddy, and he had this stump of this leg all wrapped in this bloody bandage. And he said, "Sledgehammer, you think I'm going to lose my leg?" And my God, there was his boondocker, which was his field shoe, you know, up on the stretcher with him with this stump of the ankle sticking out of him. And if you don't think that didn't just about tear my guts out. And I thought, what in the hell are we doing? It, trying to this nasty, stinking, muddy ridge, and what's this all about? You know what I mean? And then the next guy that came by was a kid who was, he wanted to see, immediately the corpsman gave the guys morphine, and either from shock or from the effects of the morphine, they rarely were vocal, how wounded were. Well, you read in history about the cries of the wounded and all. And you know, I'd often thought, well, you know, so what? What does that mean? Well, we had some Jap wounded at Polo, and frankly, it never bothered me. Well, the guy said, let the bastard, let him yell, you know. I mean, that was the attitude. But anyway, this guy came by, and he was just crying and moaning and talking about that it hurt so bad. And we said to the corpsman, you know, said, Doc, give him something. You know, my God, this poor kid, Lewis was his name. I said, Lewis, just about, he's in agony. And the corpsman said, he's in shock. His veins have collapsed. I can't give him anything else. And the kid was saying, I'll never forget, it was just raining, you know, and shells were it started coming in, and stretcher teams were trying to get him out through this damn practically knee-deep mud. And this boy who asked me about his leg, they didn't get any more than 20 feet on past me. Then the stretcher team stopped. They were Marines, you know. And they looked at each other and just put the stretcher down and then covered the guy with his poncho. He died, you know, just right after he spoke to me. And this other kid that was moaning and groaning so much, he said, oh, Jesus Christ, it hurts so bad. Make it stop hurting. And, you know, he had been no more than 20 feet from me, you know, and we asked the corpsman, you know, why can't you stop it? And the corpsman said, because his veins had collapsed. Yeah. Because this kid died in a few minutes, you know. And of all those, the two guys next to me and the three guys in the next hole, all of them died but Layden. And yet he can't get compensation for concussion, see.
Yeah.
I wrote his senator from New York and asked him to please help, but I don't think they understand. You know, I mean, it's got to be on the record. They don't have concussion.
Oh, right. You know, something you say here, I've got it really with you. You spoke of a phrase in the book that wasted lives on a muddy slope. You're talking about the Japanese guy who died, you know, he fought, and the guys were shooting him. And one of the guys, let the poor bastard alone.
He can't.
Wasted lives on a muddy slope. That could apply to both sides, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, just, and then people talk about, you know, I saw a thing about Iwo Jima, a book about Iwo Jima, the most glorious amphibious operation in history. And I've, particularly since With the Old Breedies come out, I've had letters, real nice letters, from a lot of Iwo Jima veterans. And a lot of them have said that Iwo Jima was more similar to Peleliu than any
Yeah.
of the Pacific
sure
battle they ever read about.
Yeah, sure.
Probably it was a smaller operation, but it was very similar, you know. And what was glorious about it?
Yeah.
You see, these words get applied to this stuff.
By the way, that's good. I think I might end with that. What was glorious about it? I think I'll end your profile with that. You're saying there were glorious battle. What was glorious about it? Yeah. I think I just ended with that, really. This is beautiful. What you give me is just what I want.
I hope it is.
Oh,
now, don't you put me on.
No, I'm not. I wouldn't. I know exactly where it's going to fit. And I wouldn't come down to see you, would I? I can tell from the book, you know. See, because it's different. See, the added horror is what makes it different from the European, which is bad enough. But here.
Oh, yeah.
And so the American plus the Japanese feeling being different than the German about war, therefore the American kid's feeling toward the Japanese was more hate than toward the young Germans
us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I have no... Yeah, I've heard of these... I saw a TV show one time on something about Return to the River Kwai, but they had some prisoners go back, and they wanted the American and English prisoners to go back and meet the former Japanese captors on this bridge, you know. Then some American wouldn't go, and this newsman said, well, why? And the guy said, you just don't understand. Now, there are people who will tell you now that they have no hatred, they felt no hatred, and so forth. I don't feel active hatred toward the Japanese, because I think hatred just eats you up inside. Right. But I think we all tend to mellow. But I think you have to be realistic about the way it really was. And that's one thing I think that many people don't understand, that there was bitter hatred, and that's just the way it was. It was a reality. And to me, the only things, as I said in the book, that had any merit, of course, we had to win the war. I mean, World War II, any fool knows that it was either win all or lose all. I mean, there was no choice there. But the thing that will always stand out in my mind is my buddies and the dedication to each other. And I think that they were extraordinary. And I think it was because they believed in this country, basically. Well, I don't think they would... I think it was the way we had been educated, the way we'd been disciplined at home, and we had the ability to stick to it till it was over. Because it had been awful easy to just bow out of it and say, I've had enough, I can't take anymore. But you couldn't do that.
As you were talking now, something you said last night, you can talk as you drive, and this won't disturb you, will it?
No.
You said how the book came to be, the diary, and you mentioned the New Testament. How did that move? Why don't you just reflect on it just as you're driving?
Well... My parents had both taught me the value of history and the fact that both of my grandfathers had been in the Confederate Army, and we had many letters from one of them who had been an infantry captain and was captured, and he didn't talk anything about the glory of war. All he talked about was how terrible it was and the reality of it, and he was finally released from prison, and because of his health, he came home and became ill, and he was a lawyer. He became a minister after the Civil War and Methodist minister. And then the other grandfather, though, who was a surgeon, we didn't have any letters remaining from him. And so when I got overseas, I decided that really it was really the third day at Peleliu, and amidst all that confusion and violence and fear, I realized that this was a momentous event, and I was just one little tiny wheel in the cog in the wheel, excuse me, and that I should write all this down, if I survived, for my family, so the family would know what it was really like. And also, Studs, there were many basic questions about military history and so forth that I had never found the answers to in all the reams of material I had read as a boy about the Civil War and World War I, and that is how the troops felt, what they did, what it was really like to a man in fierce combat. We knew what the general said, what he thought, what he ate, and all this, but, you know, the guys out there doing the killing and trying to survive. So those were some of the questions that I wanted to be able to put on paper. Well, we were read a division order before we embarked from Pavuhu in Russell Island, where our base camp was, that there would be no diaries. The troops would not keep diaries. And this was because in the event that you got killed and your body couldn't be recovered, even though in the Marines we always made every effort to recover all the dead, in the event that any diary might get captured for the Japs, they might get information from them. And so I couldn't keep a diary, so I kept little notes on slips of paper. And when things quieted down and nobody was really watching, and sometimes this would be a period of days before I could do it, I would write down these notes and keep them on slips of paper and keep them in my little New Testament. And I had a little Gideon's New Testament that they passed out to the troops in World War II. And I kept it in a rubber bag that I got off the Jap, the kind they carried their professional papers in, photographs and so forth. And I kept my testament in that, the New Testament, because it was either wet with sweat or wet with rain all the time. But anyway, I made all these notes, see, of things that I wanted to remember, various details. And things like casualties and things like that at the level of our company, which was in combat, that's all you knew was what was going on in your company. Because you couldn't see or know what was going on anywhere else, and you really didn't care much. You were just trying to survive with your buddies and all. So the casualty figures I had to commit to memory, because I knew if I should ever get caught with these notes, I'd be severely disciplined for disobeying orders in the first place. And with casualty figures written down, they would really lower the boom on me, which is understandable. I mean, we'd been told not to do that. But in any event, I did it, and that's how I was able to keep all the details that I kept that were never recorded anywhere else. And that after the war was over, I sat right down as soon as I got home and wrote out a long outline of the whole, the whole episode and of both campaigns and training, because I think the training was so important, because that's what enabled us to do what we did in combat and withstand the severe stress that was just almost beyond human endurance. And it was the training, to me that was so extremely important. And anyway, I made this outline, and then subsequently it got material from the Marine Corps historical section. And
so you kept it in the New Testament?
Yeah.
Inserted in the pages of...
Inserted in the pages, and then on the flyleaf of the New Testament, I wrote certain things down, too, and in the back of it, I wrote certain things down that I figured they wouldn't, if I was seen with that, it would be any
different. Did you refer to the New Testament often on
occasion? Oh, yeah. Because I always, anytime we made an attack, I recited the 23rd Psalm.
Did you?
Yeah, all the time.
But the Lord is my shepherd?
Yeah, right. And that was my... I got a great deal of, comfort from that. But on the battlefield, every man is basically, you might say, alone with God, or whatever God he believes in, or if he doesn't believe in God, he's alone with chance, I guess. And as old Snafu Shelton says, that I don't know what it was that brought us through, because I was doing a hell of a lot of cussing, and Sledgehammer was doing a hell of a lot of praying, and one or the other brought us through.
Who said that?
Snafu Shelton.
Snafu Shelton.
Yeah, Merrill Shelton.
Yeah, that's a good phrase. Cussing, he didn't have a...
Oh, yeah.
So you always recited what you before every attack.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of times doing a shelling, because that was so... felt so utterly helpless, I still have that little New Testament. I still read it.
I'll be darned, yeah.
But, and at the First Division reunions, the gunny sergeant who survived, Hank Boys, and the only officer in the company, Stumpy Stanley, who became the commander at Peleliu after Captain Haldane was killed, Stumpy Stanley and Hank Boys always say, "Sledgehammer, we're so damn glad we never knew you were keeping those notes in that New Testament. We just figured you were awfully pause, with all that always had that New Testament out every time we stopped it."
Yeah, they figured you were what? You were
pious.
Oh, you're awfully pious.
Yeah.
Oh, that was it. Yeah.
Of course, part of the time I was reading the New Testament, part of the time I was jotting notes down.
Well, were you considered pretty much the pious one of the group?
No, not more so than anybody else.
Yeah.
Some of the guys were very, but anyway, what I was going to say was Stumpy and Hank Boys always say, "You're so glad we didn't know you were keeping those notes. We'd made you throw them away."
We had
to tear them up. But some of the guys were very religious, but some of them after a while got so fatalistic, they just apparently figured, it's just nothing but dumb chance anyway as to whether you survive.
That's interesting. Chance.
Have you ever read the poem by Wilfred Owen of World War I?
Oh, he's a great poet.
The Insensibility?
No.
I'll have to send you a copy of that, because the basic theme of insensibility is the man who can go through combat and not be bothered by the deaths of others and escape chance's strange arithmetic, as he calls it, and the doubt and tease of shelling. And the man who can go through combat and not be bothered by other men's deaths and his development and sensibility, not through any intent, but through what war has done to him, he's the fortunate one.
Mm.
Because then he doesn't suffer as much as the one who is sensitive to the deaths and suffering of his comrades. And but then Owen also says in the poem that you can't compare this man to the old man at home who's never gone anywhere and who's never done anything, and he's just calloused and hardened to everything and has no compassion. They're two totally different things.
Yeah.
That the young combat man out there on the front line develops insensitivity because this is the only way he can cope with it mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And he hates to see his buddies killed, and yeah.
It's called insensitivity or insensibility?
Insensibility.
Insensibility. We're on.
Wilfred Owen. I've got Xerox in my briefcase. I'll send you
Wilfred Owen and
Siegfried Sassoon.
Rupert Brook.
You know, you.
Siegfried Sassoon.
You mentioned Fussell, a few cells.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Fussell.
Fussell, yeah. Well,
he wrote this.
Class. But, you know, he also wrote a marvelous book.
The Great War.
The Great War, Modern Memory. And
yeah.
I wrote him in
you like that book.
Oh, well,
I didn't read that.
He did such a fantastic
yeah.
job.
Yeah.
And he brought, there were so many parallels between what he, see, he was an infantryman in World War II in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wrote this book about World War I. And there's so many parallels between what Fussell talks about in World War I and what we experienced on the front lines in the Pacific in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even with all the technology, the basic similarity. But he wrote me that he has a book, I think it is just out, was supposed to come out October.
For class?
No, not on a class, but one called The Long Journey of Siegfried Sassoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he told me in the letter that he has photographs in it. And that, you see, Sassoon wrote Memoirs of an Infantry Officer, and then he wrote those wonderful war poems about World War I, and then, you know, he came back home on leave and got together with Bertrand Russell and tried to get involved in getting the war stopped.
Yeah.
You may be aware of that.
Sassoon did.
Yeah, but he was a highly respected infantry officer.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert, he thought he would be disciplined for it, and he would, you know, this is the way he would make his point. He had been decorated in France before he did this, before he came back on leave.
Yeah, this guy had the credentials.
Yeah, right. And he was a good friend of Wilfred Owens and also of Robert Graves, and who later wrote so much in mythology. And Robert Graves went to the medical people and told them, look, Sassoon is not breaking regulations. He just has simply got neurasthenia, they called it then. Or, in other words, combat fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sassoon was not disciplined, and he explains all this in his semi-biographical Memoirs of an Infantry Officer, and said that his attempt to, you know, at pacifism and to get the war stopped was apparently not going to lead anywhere. So he thought the only thing for him to do was to go back out, as they called it in England, to be with the troops and try to do as much as he could to lead the troops that he had led earlier in the war. And so he went back out into combat and was later severely wounded and sent back to England and, of course, wrote all those fine poems. But Fussell has just... Sassoon had a semi-biographical character he called George Shaston, and this was really himself. And so apparently Fussell has put a lot of this together. He called it the
journey,
the long journey of Siegfried Sassoon, because one of the books was in the semi-biographical series was called Shaston's Journey. Because he's talking about himself, you know,
Chris Beecham, K Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Regiment,
right.
Of the 1st Marine Division.
That's right.
That is it. And I'm with you. It's over. Damn you, Studs Terkel, man. Why didn't you record more of your conversation with Sledge? Why don't we have more of it? But I think you can see, just what an incredible guy Sledge was. I mean, the conversation ranges from, how he kept notes in his Bible, which is kind of funny, right? And, his company commander after Captain Haldane was killed on Peleliu, and his company gunny say, "We just thought you were pious." And Sledge talks about taking a bag that he found on a dead, what he says is a dead Jap, and, taking it for himself so he could store his Bible in it so it would never get wet and it would survive. And he says, "I still have that Bible and I still read from it." So you hear that part of him. And you hear him talking about how important training is in life. Right, how important their training was for them as they fought a brutal peer. So I think, young Marines should hear that. You want to fight a peer? This is why you got to get after your training. So your behavior becomes instinctive. And you know what to do when the shit hits the fan. And it can't be easy. I think that's good. And then the other thing that he says, and you hear Terkel constantly kind of reframing, right? Terkel, he's listening to Sledge, but he's framing it in his book. And he hears these phrases that, Sledge uses. Right, and you can hear him putting this part of the book together, and he seizes on the line, "Wasted lives on a muddy slope." Right, simple stuff, but complex. Right, chunking in very, very graphic, kind of pregnant terms, chunking this phrase, and so you see Terkel do that a lot, but you see. You listen to Sledge talking about, combat poetry and different books people have wrote. Paul Fussell, who's written a number, and his perspective is of a junior officer in Europe during World War II. And he very much the same kind of guy, I would imagine, very much the same kind of guy that Sledge is. But you get this sense of who Gene Sledge was listening to this. And it's... I think it's just an absolutely wonderful portrait of a guy who I wished I could have known. And I wished I could have had in-depth discussions, the kind I have with Jack Riley, who knew Gene Sledge. Very cool. I sent these to Jack yesterday and had a conversation with him. And I said, "I want you to listen to him, and then I want you to come on and talk about Gene Sledge." He said, "Oh, Mac, I'd love to." And he said, "90 minutes?" And I said, "Yeah. Yeah, I stumbled into these poking around looking for Gene Sledge stuff." And he said, "Wow, I can hardly wait." He just forwarded those interviews to a bunch of people and CC'd me on it. And so very cool stuff. Very cool stuff. But like I said, the coolest part of all of this is the humanity of Eugene Sledge. What a great human being he was. How fortunate, the Marine Corps was that Gene Sledge, in spite of his brother being an Army officer, joined the Marine Corps. And he comes to my attention not only because the book is such an incredible book when you read it, and the details he includes in it are amazing in it, right? And so... when you look at that, and then I was really curious when the Pacific you know, was being produced. I'm like, they're not going to put that stuff in there, though. It's probably a little bit too graphic. And they put it in there, all of it. But as I watched that, I think for a lot of people, and myself included, the most pointed scene is the one I use constantly in post-traumatic warning. And that is after the war, he comes home and he's attempting to put his life back together. And his dad wants him to go hunting just like they did before the war. And he doesn't want to go because he doesn't want to see an animal thrash who's been shot but not killed, because that will unleash the images in his head that he doesn't want to see. But he doesn't want to disappoint his father, who he has incredible respect for. And you get a sense that when you read his letters, and I'll, like I said, I'll include a link to the digital archives of Auburn University, where you can read Sledge's letters and see pictures and things like that. And just a note, if you click on a letter, you'll see the handwritten, right, scanned letter. And it's not easy to read all the handwriting sometimes. If you scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page, they transcribe everything for you. So you can read the typed letter. It's much easier on your eyes. So anyway, but you get a sense of how much he respected and loved his parents. He talks about while he's on either Peleliu or Okinawa, the family dog dies, and Sledge writes about it, and writes about how much he loves his mother and father, and how much he's can't wait to come home and whatnot. So it's just an incredible portrait of this guy. But the power of that scene that I include in post-traumatic winning, how he deals with it in a culture, right, how he tells that story and is very honest in a day and age where you didn't do that. You know, in so many different ways, Gene Sledge is a different guy. And so, I thoroughly enjoy reading about him, learning about him, and I'll find more people that know him and drag him on the program and talk about him. So, anyway, thanks for listening today. Don't touch that dial. More of Auburn Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.